This is The Health Show, a presentation of National Productions.
Doing a program about healthcare means that once in a while you'll hit on a controversial topic. We did that last week with hormone replacement therapy, and we'll talk a little more about that next week. But one topic that shouldn't be controversial but still is childhood immunizations.
These diseases are here. They can come back quickly.
On today's Health Show, we'll talk to an infectious disease expert from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Then we'll hear from an author who has taken the life lessons of people aged 85 and older and presented them to help us age on our own terms. And we'll hear a writer talk about switching roles with his aging mom. Dr. Nina Sachs is away this week. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Health Show. Last week, I got a chance to tour the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention campus in Atlanta. My group had only 3 hours at the CDC, and there was no way to even scratch the surface of what they do in those buildings. One thing I did notice is just about everyone there at the CDC was willing to talk about vaccines. The last week in April is National Infant Immunization Week, an annual awareness campaign from the World Health Organization and the CDC to highlight the importance of protecting infants from vaccine-preventable diseases. Here to talk about the importance of immunization is Dr. Jane Seward, Deputy Director of the CDC's Division of Viral Diseases in the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. Dr. Seward, we're seeing a resurgence of some vaccine-preventable diseases like whooping cough and measles. Is that why the big push this year?
Well, measles is a very good example of what happens if people choose not to get vaccinated. In fact, last week, CDC released the measles reported numbers from 2011, and we really had a big year for measles last year with 222 reported cases, the highest number for 15 years in the United States. Due to the success of the measles vaccine program, I mean, most children in the country get vaccinated for measles, and so we have pretty high immunity in the population, and we've managed to stop measles from being a year-round disease here. But measles is a plane ride away, and so anybody who goes overseas can easily catch measles in a variety of countries, including in Europe. So last year, we had 72 different known importations of measles from overseas, most of those in returning U.S. travelers who weren't vaccinated. And half of those people traveled to Europe, including France.
Now, I'm of an age when I grew up, I had measles, I had chicken pox. Why are these being vaccinated against? What is the danger there?
Well, that's a great question. I had them, too, as a child. And let's take measles as an example. I mean, fortunately, most people who got measles did recover from the illness. But every year in the United States, in the 50s and early 60s, before we had a vaccine, everybody got measles. And so we had about 3 or 4 million cases every year back then. But what people don't realize is that 400 to 500 people died every year of measles, every single year, and most of those cases of death were children, and almost 50,000 people were hospitalized every year. That's a lot, year after year after year, of very serious consequences from measles. So that's why we vaccinate. I mean, people developed vaccines because of the severe outcomes of the diseases. Even chickenpox, that most people think of as not a serious disease, every year in the U.S. there are 100 deaths a year, and most of those were in children, and about 12,000 hospitalizations. And I've talked to a parent whose healthy 5-year-old died of chickenpox. They would have given anything to be able to prevent that through vaccination.
We see some of the numbers coming from the CDC that there were a few dozen deaths due to whooping cough in 2010, I believe it was. Are some of these diseases coming back because parents just never grew up with these diseases and figure, well, this isn't a problem anymore, why vaccinate my kids?
Well, I think many parents are not reminded on a daily basis, they were decades ago, of the severe, ongoing occurrence of these diseases. Whooping cough, unlike measles, has not been completely eliminated from the United States as far as year-round transmission. it's very much reduced from the time when before a vaccine was used, but it still occurs. And we need many doses of that vaccine, you know, 5 during childhood, an adolescent booster dose, an adult booster dose, to maintain our immunity to prevent whooping cough. And so it is very important across the age spectrum for the very reason you just mentioned. It's the tiny babies who are often too young to have received their series of shots yet and be well protected by 5 or 6 months worth from having 3 shots, who can die from whooping cough. And they could get it from older siblings or parents or grandparents or people who look after them. And so it's really important that people who are around babies be up to date with their whooping cough shots.
Most of these vaccines are given out on a strict schedule from birth to 3 months to 6 months. What's the importance of giving these vaccines at the time they're suggested?
Yes, that's a very good question. The reason is that we want to protect children from 14, you know, serious and potentially deadly diseases before their second birthday. And those diseases can occur at very young ages. And so we give the vaccines at the earliest time that we can to provide immunity early in life before infants or young children are exposed to these serious diseases like measles and whooping cough and HIB, which can cause meningitis. If we delayed, you know, those diseases would be very, very common again, and young infants would be getting ill and potentially dying from those diseases. These diseases are here. They can come back quickly. And the best way to protect their child is to have the vaccines.
Now, this is a little off topic, but we are talking about vaccines, and I did take that tour last week. I see the CDC is going overseas to help with polio and trying to eradicate polio. Could you just get into that a little bit and tell what the CDC is doing to help overseas?
Yes. I mean, the work that we do overseas is actually very, very important because it protects children around the world, but it also protects us here at home because if there's better control of those diseases overseas, then they're unlikely to come into this country and infect people here. So for polio, there's been tremendous progress in polio becoming a rare disease in many countries, but 3 countries now, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nigeria, have yet to stop transmission in their countries. India managed to do that just a few months ago, so it was a very big achievement for India to stop transmission of polio through, you know, huge efforts to vaccinate all the children there, as we'd been doing here in the United States for many years. And these diseases are crippling still in developing countries. In fact, there was an article in Lancet highlighting that now, still, with the most recent estimates being 2010, measles results in 139,000 deaths. That's 380 children a day dying of measles every day around the world. And every one of those deaths can be preventable through vaccination. So the work we do overseas for polio and measles and introducing some of the newer vaccines, you know, helping WHO and countries introduce new vaccines, like vaccines to prevent rotavirus diarrhea, to prevent serious meningitis and pneumonia in young infants, that's very important work for helping children around the world and also helping protect our populations at home.
And as you say, it's just some of these diseases are just a plane ride away.
Oh, absolutely, especially measles. If you're in a room with someone with measles because it's spread through the air, you've got a greater than 9 chances out of 10 of becoming a case yourself if you don't have protection through either having had the disease as a child or through vaccination.
Dr. Jane Seward is Deputy Director of CDC's Division of Viral Diseases in the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases. Still to come, we can't stop the aging process, but we can do it on our own terms. We'll explain next on The Health Show. You can find The Health Show anytime online at healthshow.org. Search the archive and listen to whole programs you may have missed or would like to hear again. Even subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. You can also follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And a quick note, if you subscribe to The Health Show's podcast and haven't been getting it for the past 2 weeks, go to healthshow.org again and subscribe again. It'll work. You can start your own Health Show archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for Health Show number 1257. This is The Health Show. I'm Bob Barrett. America is rapidly getting older. Between now and 2030, the number of people in the U.S. over the age of 80 is expected to almost triple. But how long people live also raises the question of how well they live. In her new book, Aging Our Way, author Mika Lowe follows the everyday lives of 30 elders between the ages of 85 and 102, living at home and mostly alone, to understand how they create and maintain healthy, comfortable, and meaningful lives for themselves. Mika Lowe recently spoke with The Health Show's Joe Donahue, who asked her how she got started with this book.
Well, I guess there are two answers to that question. One is that I was fortunate to be very close with my grandparents and great-grandparents and learned a lot from them. Their questions became my questions as they lost their spouses and moved into aging at home alone. And then asking questions about what creates a meaningful life and a purpose-driven life. I have one remaining grandparent, maternal side, who's one of my best friends. So that was one inspiration. The other one is that I work 2 hours from home, and so I live in two different communities, and I rent a room from a local elder, and she opened this whole world up to me of essentially widows living in their homes alone, connecting with each other and caring for each other, and that totally inspired me.
It seems to me, and my father is 85 years old, lives at home alone. But it seems to me that if you ask many, I was going to say older people, but even people as they advance an elder age of what the ideal scenario would be, this is it, right?
Nine out of 10 Americans want to live at home.
Yeah. They don't want to leave what they've had.
That's right.
Now, what I find interesting about your work and what's interesting about the book is that living at home is one thing. That meaningful part is really the key to this.
Right.
So why is that such a challenge?
Why is that? I think that's a challenge at all stages of life. I mean, I talk with my college students about what is meaningful to you, this vitality question. I think in terms of the oldest old, so your father and my grandfather, we think about old age in terms of care and in terms of disease and in terms of frailty, and we forget to ask questions, continue to ask questions about what constitutes a meaningful life.
And do we forget or do they forget?
I think all of us lose sight of it. And sometimes it takes learning about that individual's life to understand how to tap into their vitality. So, for example, Eddie, who I talk about in the book, he was the elevator operator at our state capitol in Albany for 32 years. And he loved that job. It was all about greeting people every morning, the Rockefeller, Cuomo, all the governors. He was the morning greeter, essentially, at the capitol. And here he is now. He's in his 90s. And somehow he figured out that being with people and greeting people on a regular basis is what he does well and keeps him vital. And so he's there this morning, in fact, at the Jewish Community Center in Albany, right outside the door of the fitness center, greeting people with a smile. No elevator door this time, but, you know, he jokes with them. He calls all the women Marilyn Monroe, and that's the way he starts his day. And so, you know, that's for him something he did beautifully during his younger years that he's still doing.
So the question is, what's the message you hope to get across?
Well, I think one of the messages is we can learn from those who are 85 and older. When they're looking back on their lives, they know more about what it means to live a purpose-driven life than most of us.
Right.
And the lessons that I've learned from them, I want to convey those and have us work on some of those lessons. They're lessons for all of us at all stages of life. You know, maybe we're starting a new chapter of life. Maybe we're facing retirement. Maybe we're graduating from college. You know, whatever the stage of life, these are important lessons, whether it's connecting with people, which as a sociologist, that's a key social capital is one of the most important things.
Right.
But also caring for others, giving back, the importance of humor and touch.
And a lot of this is preparation, isn't it? I mean, because you never know what's going to happen. You never know what curveball is going to come. But that preparation and at least openness to what the possibilities are, I guess, is important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you look at the people that you talk to for the book, these 30 people, they all lived at home, and but mostly alone. But there is obviously the health aspect to it, mm-hmm. and so caretaking comes into this, doesn't it?
That's right. And so several of the lessons that I learned from them are about reaching out to family, asking for care, also outsourcing for care. And I should note, again, this is something that we don't just do at 85 or 90. I'm doing it at 38. You know, I depend on a milkman to deliver my milk every morning. I depend on a babysitter for my child. So, you know, people don't think about those who are in late life hiring and firing. But in fact, they are. They're creating care networks for themselves.
Mm. And what is your thought, and just circling back to something that we were talking about earlier, of the caretakers, the family, their involvement in that?
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously the person usually wants their independence.
Yes.
You want them to have their independence, and yet you also want their safety and care. And that's a delicate balance.
It sure is.
So how do you find that, do you think?
Well, you know, I talk about this with my college students, that delicate balancing act, as you say, between autonomy and dependence. It's something throughout our lives that we struggle with.
Yeah.
I see it with my 4.5-year-old. I find, and I've found through, you know, these 3 years of research following these elders through the challenges and joys of aging, that those who ask for help actually enable their autonomy. It's sort of, you know, it doesn't quite make sense when you think about it, but in fact it does. If you ask for someone to help you, in Ruth's case, chop vegetables, then you can make the meal.
Mm.
And that's something that keeps her life vital, is being able to, you know, prepare a meal for herself every night with fresh vegetables. If you hire someone or ask someone to walk with you because you may be a little unstable, then you get that exercise and you get the social interaction as well. So asking for help and assistance can enable autonomy for most of these individuals. And that's one of the most important lessons that I've learned from these elders.
So being conscious of and identifying your deficiencies so you can fuel your capabilities.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
Again, the name of Mika Lowe's book is Aging Our Way. She spoke with the Health Show's Joe Donahue. As we talk about aging and approach Mother's Day, we remember the woman who took care of us and was there when we needed her most. Today, author Judah LeBlanc talks about his feelings now that those roles have been reversed.
The cell phone sits on the edge of my office desk, dominating my mind. I wait, trying to ignore it, and focus on a report I'm writing for my day job. The report isn't creative, but requires my full attention. Yet I can't seem to concentrate on the words, and can't retain their meaning as they skitter around my computer screen like marbles. I'm fragmented, my body in an office building in Porter Square, Cambridge, my mind back in suburban Cleveland. My mother is 83, twice widowed, and wound tight like the springs of an old clock. In the past 5 years, she's been buffeted by the waves of old age and the challenges that come along with it. The loss of many friends and her second husband, a fall and broken bones, and now another loss of her appetite. My mother's weight loss has gone hand in hand with her misfortunes. the stress of dealing with her late husband's decline and mood swings, interspersed with her fall and a fractured femur, which caused my mother to shed about 20 pounds in a year. As her husband Paul deteriorated, my mother continued to get leaner, anxiety whittling her down into a tiny angular woman, all planes and sharp edges. A week before her husband died, I was back in Cleveland, trying to provide moral support. By then, Mom was living on bottles of Ensure. But after Paul's death, my mother rallied, relieved on some level, that both his suffering and her caretaking were over. Still, I watched her social circle, formerly wide and deep, now thinned down like her 80-year-old body, shrink as her friends passed away or struggled with illness. Then in the fall of 2010, my mother was rushed to the hospital with abdominal pain. Her appendix had ruptured. Her recovery was long and tenuous, but she did recover, determined to regain her independence. Another bullet dodged by this frail woman, who stands about 5 feet tall and weighs 90 pounds. My two brothers and I tracked her progress, and two of us made trips to Cleveland to urge her on. But my brothers rarely go back to our hometown to visit, and so my mother relies on her dwindling number of friends and to some extent on me. After my last visit in December, I noticed that my mother's appetite had gone from bird-like to non-existent. Suddenly it was all about role reversal. There I was, her 50-something son, pleading, cajoling her to have dessert or between-meal snacks. "Hey, Ma, I got this just for you. Come on, just one bite." A few weeks after my visit, I learned that my mom weighed 88 pounds at her last doctor's visit. She had lost 5 pounds in the last 4 months. That figure propelled me into action. I called her doctor, set up a plan with my mother's social worker, arranging for weekly weigh-ins at home. We also set up a system to ensure her use of nutritional supplements, Boost or Ensure, from 1 to 2 a day. The system, such as it was, depends on my mother's cooperation and motivation. I'd been trying to increase her caloric intake by long distance and during my visits to Cleveland with limited effect. I was hoping that Rita, Mom's social worker, would have better luck. The phone sat on my desk while I waited for a text, a message that would give me a number and a sense of whether my mother was going in the right or the continued wrong direction. Finally, my phone vibrated, shuddered, jumped, as did I when I heard the sound. I grabbed the phone and read quickly, looking for a number. Last week, she'd been down to 88 pounds, now back to 88.5. Half a pound. It was something, nothing, not what I wanted. Soon after, I placed another call to my mother's doctor, searching for the answers he may not have. Then I slipped the phone into my pocket, silenced for now. My body remained in a small, glassed-in office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. My mind, 700 miles west on the shores of Lake Erie, where my mother lies adrift, like a rowboat in a lake-effect storm.
Judah LeBlanc is a writer and teacher living in Boston. His latest book is called Finding My Place, One Man's Journey from Cleveland through Boston and Beyond. Learn more and view Judah performing some of his stories at judahleblanc.com. And before we go, I wanted to let you know that our friend and frequent commentator Sandy Daigler has started a blog about her weight loss and weight maintenance. You can find Sandy's blog at one-little-cookie.blogspot.com. That's all the time we have for this week's Health Show. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at healthshow.org. You can explore the archive for any programs you might have missed or would like to hear again. You can also subscribe to our podcast. That's healthshow.org. Want more? Then follow us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/thehealthshow. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is letters@healthshow.org. I promise, Dr. Nina Sachs will be back with us next week. I'm Bob Barrett. Till then, stay healthy and be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Health Show.
Dr. Nina Sachs is a practicing member of the American College of Gastroenterology. Bob Barrett is producer of The Health Show. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Health Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.